You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of AIDS 2008, the 17th International AIDS Conference. The conference took place in Mexico City from August 3rd through August 8th, 2008.
My name is Ulrich Marcus. I'm from Germany. I'm working at the Robert Koch Institute in Berlin. This is more a general statement, not a specific question. In Germany, we made the experience after the publication of the Swiss statement that there is some, well, expectation from the community that we adopt a similar statement in Germany. And what we see is that the pressure to adopt a similar statement comes mostly from the MSM community, not from heterosexual people who are infected with HIV. So what do people understand if they hear the message from the Swiss statement, whose first desire is not to get a child in a serodiscordant relationship, who are not monogamous, and who come from a community, HIV positive, MSM, have in recent years experienced in Europe and in North America, well, a rise of co-epidemics of other sexually transmitted infections. We have STI incidences in HIV positive MSM of bacterial STIs in the range of 30 to 50% per year. That's very high incidences of STI, of bacterial STI co-infections. So how do people understand this message, and how do they want to act on these messages? If you look at HIV serodiscordant couples in MSM, then we can see from studies we did that the HIV positive partner in such a serodiscordant couple has a higher STI incidence than the HIV negative partner in such a serodiscordant couple, which is related to another strategy that has evolved in recent years in HIV positive, mainly in HIV positive MSM, which is serosorting. Okay. So not taking condoms if they think their partner has the same zero status.
Okay.
Which is a strategy.
If I could, okay. You have a lot of issues there for the panel to look at. Okay. So let's stop there. There's another question.
My name is Ron Barham from the United States, from Columbia University. I think there's a little confusion on the panel, actually, because the statement by Nancy Palian and the statement that I thought I understood as coming from the Swiss statement were completely different. My understanding was that the Swiss statement did not say that couples should continue to use condoms and be on therapy, but rather that the option was available where a discussion had taken place about whether to use condoms or not. That's a very, very different statement. I think we have to be clear about what the Swiss statement was saying. The other thing about potential risks with viral blips, etc., you know, there is no such thing as risk-free existence. And the question is, if there is the potential for a viral blip, and if there is the potential for a viral blip in conjunction with an STI, I'm not talking about Africa now, then the question is, how often will these occur, and on a population basis, what risk is created? That, it seems to me, is the question. Not whether there's zero risk. Pregnancies aren't zero risk. Having penicillin isn't zero risk. So I think the idea of trying to place the level of risk in the context of what in research we describe as negligible risks is precisely the way to go.
Thank you. And one last question.
Manuel Badege, Switzerland. Actually, as a disclosure, I was in a subclinical commission also regarding these guidelines. Just a very short statement and then a question. First, I would like to say that these guidelines are really an excellent instrument for physicians to have really very good thoughts about this situation. So my questions to all non-Swiss panelists is there a movement now to do guidelines, at least I say now for the Western world, as there are treatment guidelines for developing countries and developed countries, they may differ. but to have a comprehensive guidelines which take into account some very good thoughts of this excellent symposium. I congratulate the organizers because I think the time is ripe. I see that there is not a real great contradiction what is said. There are very good caveats we discuss with patients, and nevertheless, I think it would be very useful not to just say the guidelines are not optimal or this and that, but that we go on a way, even if data is lacking, as we did before in all fields of medicine, where evidence is not complete, to have comprehensive worldwide guidelines. I think the time would be ripe.
Thank you. So we have a number of key questions to the panel. The first was the example from Germany, where there was pressure within Germany not to make a statement from, in this case, the MSM community, for, among other reasons, fear of STI epidemic or other co-infections. There was a question of how the message has been received in Switzerland in terms of the statement. What has been the response? There was a question about the movement in other countries from our last questioner here. Will this have an impact in other countries to follow suit or continue further study? And then a question specific to the Swiss statement, what did it say about condoms relative to transmission? And questions about viral blips and risk level. So why don't we start from this end of the panel and see who else wants to respond to these many questions.
Thank you. I take the liberties to start. One thing that I would like to make sure that these are shouldn't be questions and answers. It's not that we have the answers. I think there's a big group of experts in the room, and I would just enjoy if we could discuss these issues. So for the German experience, I don't really know what the problem is. But one thing I can tell you from the experience in Switzerland after the statement, I think we have never talked so much about STDs after this statement. So I think what the statement really made is to stress the importance of STDs. And it is my big hope that patients and partners would actually understand the importance and implement that and take this into their daily life. So there are many other collateral effects that we haven't expected, actually. But I wouldn't be too much concerned. I mean, I have many other issues but I have talked about it.
I'd just like to make a comment about the communications issue here. There's no doubt that physicians worldwide who are dealing with patients who have undetectable viral loads and no STDs and are in committed monogamous relationships need to be equipped to counsel them both about conception risks and about HIV transmission risks. But when one holds a press conference, we live in a very global world, that message goes out worldwide. Now, I've heard a lot of anecdotes about the effects of the statement. I'll just mention two. One from Geneva, where the organization working with sex workers in Geneva said they were having trouble explaining on the ground the meaning of the statement, that sex workers who were HIV positive and on treatment interpreted it to mean that they did not have to use condoms and therefore could make more money. The other was from the head of a National AIDS Commission who said, I asked, what happened in your country? How did you deal with the statement? And he said, we suppressed it. We did not. Journalists contacted us and we said, we have no comment. This has no relevance for our population. So I think we have to be very careful to be very sure about what we're saying and to whom it applies, because there are many negative, unintended, but negative consequences.
Well, I would just add a few points. One point is, of course, the Chakrabarty study that was shown by several different speakers was focused on heterosexual vaginal intercourse. So the probability number that was described does not relate to receptive anal intercourse. Receptive anal intercourse is much more efficient. The discussion of whether ART has the power to suppress receptive anal intercourse, we don't understand that transmission very well. It's just worth keeping in mind, based on our German colleague's statement. I'm a little concerned. Kate Hankins, indicated one of her big concerns. I'm going to criticize another panelist, take that liberty. One of her big concerns was a technical concern, that is, having the ability in a country outside the developed countries or less resource-constrained countries of measuring minimal viral load, for example. I think that's a technical problem, but there's a lot of work going on, and a lot of within a couple of years, I suspect there will be tests that are cheaper and more widely available. So I think that it would not be a reason not to pursue this line of reasoning, that technical limitation. I think that would be a soluble problem. Third, I'm a little concerned. I'm much more confident that the population level benefits, again, I'm going to argue with Kate a little, I think the population level benefits of more testing, people knowing their status, using more antivirals, that we will see reduced prevalence. And I know Julio plans on doing a study in British Columbia that I really think is worth just mentioning, because your hypothesis is population-level hypothesis, not a per-couple hypothesis. And I'm going to turn the microphone over to you and force you to mention what you're interested in a second. And lastly, in terms of the U.S. guidelines, the U.S. Guidelines or policy statements would come from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. They are having a panel meeting in October. I don't know the full scope of what will be discussed, but it certainly is related to the benefits of ART as they relate to prevention, but I don't know that they'll get into this issue, so we'll see. But they are having a meeting. Julio?
It doesn't take much to force me to talk about this issue, so I'll gladly accept. And a few years ago, we were struggling with some of these same issues, and we took the position that while we are not 100% confident at the individual level how all of this works, and you can tell that the degree of controversy around it, it's a lot easier to understand that at a populational level, if we lower the populational viral load through the use of antiretroviral therapy, we could act as an added second sort of layer of protection, and therefore see decreases in HIV transmission. I don't want to take too long to explain where that comes from, but at the end of the day, we use populational data to model these, and the data is quite compelling in the sense that we expect the direction of the effect of wider coverage of antiretroviral therapy in the population to be associated with decreasing transmission. And there is a unique window of opportunity to do this, because with the newer guidelines that greatly expand the number of people who meet a medical indication of antiretroviral therapy, and with the greater willingness of our bureaucrats and the politicians to really drive an effort to expand antiretroviral therapy, we think we are in a position to make a demonstration project out of this. I must confess that at a private level, when we have been able or asked to counsel individuals specifically on issues of procreation or for a variety of particular reasons, even before the Swiss guidelines were out, we had taken a similar position that there may be a risk. The risk would be relatively small and probably acceptable within the risk that you as an individual have demonstrated comfort since you are already engaged in a serial discordant couple, where, as you pointed out earlier, condoms do break and accidents do occur and so on and so forth. So I think that with that, I have come completely clean on this issue.
I have just one thought to add to the German colleague's statement about very elevated levels of STIs in German gays. Well, that must mean that they are not using condoms, doesn't it? And that is a problem because, you know, I have heard it said that doing the same thing twice and expecting a different result is the essence of what is stupid. And if the result of 20 years of condom promotion in Germany is that we have a very high incidence of sexually transmitted infections, then maybe it's time to look for other means of prevention. I would add that the same is true of some studies from Africa where infection rates in programs with condom promotion are shockingly high and suggest that condoms have not been used in spite of the promotion.
Just because he was not introduced, he's also going to be summarizing this session. Who just spoke was Dr. Bernard Herschel, who is a self-described dinosaur of the HIV-AIDS world. He's currently the director of the HIV-AIDS unit at the Geneva University Hospital in Geneva, Switzerland. I'm sorry, Nico?
Yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say both about the statement from the German colleague and from the Swiss physician is that indeed this highlights the need to agree on how we communicate what the data show. And we have to agree on specific counseling guidelines for doctors or other communicators towards HIV positive people. I wanted to make a comment about some of the caveats that are, I see in many slides and are mentioned many times. I wonder why Bernard doesn't trust them. For example, these so-called blips. Blips in therapy means that you have a detectable viral load of 80 or 150 or 200, but you cannot call a blip something which is 2,000. And for all the data that we that has been published, there is no transmission which has occurred when viral load is less than 1,500. Therefore, it is very probable that these blips are completely irrelevant for the increased risk of transmission. The other point I wanted to make is about the acceptable risk. It was mentioned by Ron Bayer that we live in a life where we have to accept risk. I would like to remind the audience that young people today, if they are heterosexual, they pay no attention to condoms, and even if they engage in gay practices, they also don't pay any attention to use of condom. One of the reasons being that HIV is no longer perceived as a terminal disease. So the perception of risk, even if one gets infected, has decreased very much. But what we are discussing here is not this type of behavior, but we are discussing whether it is an acceptable risk to have unprotected sex with someone who is on treatment, which is actually a lower risk than have sex with a condom with someone of unknown status or who is HIV positive. And for the prevention messages and for the prevention interventions, it is vital that we understand that the people who do not know their HIV status are actually contributing to HIV infection much more than people who have diagnosed their HIV status.
Just because my name was brought up, I feel like I have to say something. But it really just gets back to the issue about communication. Honestly, Ron, I don't understand what you thought that was a misunderstanding. But it is, just to reinforce what everyone's saying, this is a tool that and insofar as I understand it, and I don't want to speak for you guys, but this is a tool for people who are counseling to use to counsel people about potential risk. And that is, in fact, again, it's up to the negative partner, whether jointly or individually, whether they want to use condoms, knowing that. And I just think, and if I screw that up in my presentation, then I apologize.
More comments and questions from the audience? Please stand up behind the microphones.
My name is Rolanda Hodel, and I run an organization. It's called AIDS Free Africa. I do work in Africa. It's interesting to see that the entire panel is white. What I would like to beg you and plead with you is, when you speak, always make clear which population you're speaking about. In Cameroon, where I work, 2/3 of positive people are female. And the population, I have never ever seen a couple where one person is positive and the other person is negative. The infection occurs immediately in couples. And I want someone here on the panel to answer the question, have you ever calculated a percentage of people that you're actually talking about? We have 42 million people that are HIV/AIDS positive. You're talking about 2.5 million on treatment. And from those 2.5 million, actually it's only a very small part. That's the one that have no STDs, no other infections, that are monogamous, and I can go on and on. So you're speaking of a population of what, 0.001%?
Just to make a brief comment here, I think you're perfectly right, and I would like to repeat what we said in our media letter. Good news for a few individuals. And I think I couldn't agree more with what you said.
Okay.
Yep. Sir?
I'm Graham Brown from the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations. I also work in a school of public health. And my main question is that, well, I suppose, realistically, what we're looking for is being able to open up the kind of discussions that we'd like to have between within community, with doctors and so forth, so that it's actually clear, that it's honest, that it's upfront, and we can actually start talking realistically about risk and things that have been happening for some time now. My concern is that, I mean, a lot of the data in Australia, a lot of the concern and the reluctance and so forth around the statement, one of the major issues has been that the studies have been predominantly within heterosexual contexts and haven't engaged, it's not a lot of data apparently around risks of anal intercourse. What I'd like to know, and I'm happy with anyone else, is what are we then doing about that? Because it concerns me often that we tend to sometimes go down the path that if, you know, we don't know the answer, therefore we can't go there, or, you know, if there's not the evidence, that means we don't go there. What I'd like to be knowing is, if this is already happening, which we know it is, in couples, in relationships, what do we know about how this translates within anal sex? And if we don't have all the answers, how are we going to get them?
Thank you. Edwin Bernard from the UK. I'd like to ask about the other part of the statement, which was driven by the draconian HIV exposure laws, both public health and criminal laws in Switzerland. And I wonder whether there might actually be unintended negative consequences by your suggesting that the positive partner needs to disclose to the negative partner, and the negative partner needs to make the decision about whether condoms are used during unprotected sex, because HIV exposure laws are actually disclosure laws. They are HIV exposure laws that happen in jurisdictions all around the world, particularly many states in the US and all over Canada. They actually force disclosure when an HIV positive person has unprotected sex, and people are being prosecuted and are in prison for just one instance of unprotected sex without any transmission, just exposure, so no actual harm. And I wonder whether your statement actually reinforces some of these HIV exposure laws by recommending that the HIV positive person discloses that they're on treatment, discloses they have an undetectable viral load, and means that the HIV negative person has to make the choice. Because good public health education suggests that the responsibility is equal. It lies with both the HIV positive and the HIV negative person.
Thank you. I'm going to ask our moderators to please take notes, I mean our panelists to take notes of issues or questions you want to respond to, and take a couple of more statements or comments from the audience.
My name is Henrik Einstein, I'm from HIV Denmark, and we are in fact one of the countries in the world which has exposure criminalization in relation with HIV. And my question is very similar to the question before, but more specific, because you have talked about condom use and kind of put up a measurement for that, and also when people are on treatment. And I would like to just have a clear answer. Would you consider condom brackets as the same being on treatment? Because in Denmark, if you have a condom brackets, the law in Denmark don't apply anymore. So would you say that treatment would do the same in our case of our law? Thank you.
Okay. Can you repeat the question?
It wasn't quite...
The condom breakage.
I think...
Condom breakage?
Are you saying the condom breakage is criminalized? Was that what you were trying to say?
No, the condom breakage, it's when then the law don't apply anymore in Denmark. When you can prove that you have condom brackets. So if you then the law don't apply anymore in the exposure law. But what I'm saying is the equivalent of condom brackets is that the same risk as being on treatment. Does that clarify? Or?
Essentially, he's saying if you use a condom but it breaks, you're not liable. And so what is the relative of this statement to others?
from a legal side, from a legal perspective. Yes. Sir,
yeah.
Can I have you spoken already? Okay, go ahead. Well, I'd like to give the chance to folks who haven't asked a question yet, if you don't mind. Please, at the back.
It's not really a question, it's a statement, because I suppose that you also wanted to hear about the organizations of PLHIVs. Not only the statement of Nikostatis, I think what you will experience now is a live comment to Ole Markus' statement, as well as support for at least the last statement in Nico's very fine presentation. It's called the Mexico Manifesto, which has been a paper running around for the last several weeks under non-disclosure until today. The Mexico Manifesto is a call for action by people who live with HIV and AIDS. It has until now been subscribed by a considerable number from of organizations, PLHIV organizations in Europe, as well as some individuals in the US. And I don't know whether my Brazilian friends are here and they've already decided to sign as well.
Sir, can you tell us what the manifesto says?
What is the benefit of it? It's meant to support the ECHAF statement, this statement by the Swiss Commission. We PLHIVs really clearly welcome this statement, and we also draw some conclusions in the sense of requests that we wish to address to all actors and key players in the field of HIVs, as well as to the media. And finally, this could help improve some stigmatization and discrimination and criminalization defects that we are still suffering from. I didn't want to tell it, but I am the member of LIFE, the Swiss national organization, a member of the board. My name is Mick Rasmussen. And I would like Michel Meyer, who is the initial author of this manifesto, just to give you the six key sentences of this manifesto. She is actually the president of LIFE, and I didn't want to tell it. She's also my partner, and here are our two young girls. We are one of these serodiscordant partnerships, or different, what we like to say, who really engage for this statement. Thank you.
Sir, if
I could give the word to Michelle now.
Sir, if we could, before going into that, I think you have physical copies of the manifesto, and perhaps give us the electronic link. There's many other issues to discuss, and I think we want to congratulate you for your action, but continue in, with our discussion around a variety of issues, if that's okay. Okay. We have one more comment from the...
Yes, my name is Elizabeth Pisani. I think that we to go back to this issue of risk, everyone takes risks. We decide what risks we take in the light of the best available information that we have. Strategic positioning, that wasn't something that came from public health professionals. It was something that came from a community that was trying to minimize its risk and maximize its pleasure in sexual relations as best they could in front of the data that they had. And the same thing with serosorting. Now, serosorting actually is working quite well for people who are HIV positive, barebacking among people who are both positive. It's not working so well for people who are HIV negative. Why? Because if you're on Gaydar or gay.com three times a week or four times a week looking to bareback with another HIV negative partner, you're quite likely to find a partner who is undiagnosed, newly infected, very highly infectious, and therefore you put yourself at great risk. So in fact, this statement is of enormous use to people who do make sophisticated decisions about the risks that they take every day of their lives, and this just gives them an extra piece of information, which is, oh gosh, if I'm going to bareback, maybe I should do it with someone positive on treatment rather than someone who says they're negative.
I want to just, before we take more comments from the floor, ask our panel to make any responses to some of the many issues that were brought up. Hopefully you were taking notes, some of the key issues around criminalization and legalization issues. What were some of the outcomes about anal sex? How was this taken into context? And who was targeted by the statement was the first comment that we had from the floor. So all of the other issues that were brought up, does anyone want to make some comments? Kate.
Just two comments. One is that I agree with Nikos that if this puts the spotlight on undiagnosed people and encourages knowledge of HIV status, and this is a positive consequence of all of this. And I would just like to clarify for the woman that's working in Cameroon, I actually have in front of me data from DHS from five countries, including Cameroon. And basically, two-thirds of infected couples are discordant couples, two-thirds of them. In 30 to 40% of them, it's the woman that's the HIV-positive person. So I think there's an assumption among people that if one person is positive, then the other one must be as well. And we need to be really encouraging non-diagnosed couples to come forward and be tested. And if they are serodiscordant, there are things that we can offer. And part of it is treatment. Part of it might be male circumcision, certainly prevention of mother-to-child transmission. It creates the possibility for prevention and for treatment.
Excellent. Anyone else? Does anyone have any comments about the criminalization issue that was brought up?
Maybe a short comment about the criminalization issue. I think the ECOF statement was not addressing couples that do not disclose HIV information. So I couldn't see how the statement could address those couples. The legal issue that we had in Switzerland is that you are liable even if you disclosed your information to your partner, and if you have sex with your partner without condom, you actually are liable of trying to transmit an infectious disease. And we wanted to stop at least that point. So I couldn't see the other problem, right? One thing, I'm very happy with the information that Kate Hankins just corrected from Africa. I was very surprised to hear those figures. And one thing that I also would like to correct, which you said, we did actually not make a media conference. That was not our aim. We never did that. We actually wanted to respond to media conferences that have taken place already. And that is one thing that you also mentioned. The physicians, you think it's okay physicians talk to their patients. Our point was that we don't know what they talk to them. And what we realize now, they haven't talked about STDs and adherence as we do it now. So I think the statement stresses these important parts that will also answer the concerns that Mike had with, you know, resistance. I don't see a single patient who develops resistance if he is 6 months suppressed and remains with perfect adherence. That just doesn't exist.
No other comments from the panel? Okay, from the floor? Yes, sir.
So I would really welcome it if we could use the Swiss statement on reduced infectiousness under antiretroviral therapy, if we adopt it to populations like MSM, if we can use it to refocus the attention on the problem of the STI co-epidemics that have evolved in these populations. If that would be the outcome, I would welcome that very much. So far, I think the healthcare systems in countries with MSM epidemics have been very inefficient to address the STI problems in the MSM communities. So, in HIV positive men who get antiretroviral therapy, so who should see a healthcare provider at least four times per year, in Germany they have just a slightly minor STI incidence than HIV positive people who don't see a healthcare provider. So much about the efficiency of the healthcare systems to address the STI epidemics in MSM communities.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Adrian Camacho. I'm an ID fellow here in Mexico. Just a brief question. How is the Swiss government planning on doing an evaluation on the outcome of this statement, positive or negative? And should we be waiting for another statement?
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for a great panel. My name is Jim Pickett. I'm the chair of the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. And I haven't heard a lot of discussion about new prevention technologies, vaginal microbicides, rectal microbicides, PrEP. And I'm wondering how this, I think, fabulous statement and very important statement might be a way to help us push forward in the need for more technologies to protect ourselves that go beyond condoms and speak to things like pleasure and enjoyment of sex. And that could be for anybody, but perhaps the gentleman who spoke on behalf of the community.
Thank you. Any other comments from the floor, please?
My name is Michelle Meyer from Switzerland. I just wanted to say about communication. I think it's time to accept the maturity of individuals and society. So I'm wondering why we are asking what should be communicated and what not. And then I want just to say that the manifesto you can find on www.lhive.ch. So where you can see who has signed the manifest.
Just to repeat, that would be www.lhive.org, was it?
Yes?
CH, excuse me, .ch. Yes, sir?
Cyprian Martinez from Australia. I just wanted to firstly say thank you to Switzerland. I applaud you. You are magnificent, courageous, and I will stand by you 100% all the way. I would also like to ask some clarifying questions as well. Could you please clarify us how this statement, the implications that this statement has for male-to-male sex, because a lot of the studies were around heterosexual sex, and also in the direction of how do we get research on clarifying these questions? So they're the two things I'd like the panel to maybe make some comments on.
Good. One more question?
Hi, I'm David Gilden from New York City. Actually, my question is a follow-up to his question. It's also a clarifying question. There's been a lot of discussion about the role of STDs and whether that obviates the protective effect of treatment. Do we really know that people who are suppressed due to treatment then become unsuppressed, at least in your genital fluids, if they have an STD? Have there been studies, or have I missed them somehow, that detail that?
Maybe there are so many questions. I would like to start with the last one. That's the one I could remember. I would like to make this very clear. We did not say that an STD under completely suppressed treatment actually increases the risk of transmission. This is something we don't know. There is only one study I know from Birmingham, UK, where they looked at urethritis, and they found 2 out of 20 patients on the heart had a slightly increased viral load in semen during the urethritis episode. And otherwise, it was always suppressed. But we did not say those individuals are more infectious. We said if we're uncertain, if there is a confidence interval, if we're close to the place where we wouldn't be so confident, we would decide that those would be the individuals where we would be more careful. So we didn't say it is more infectious, but we just made it our concerns. I think that is an important difference.
There was a question about evaluation. Would you speak to that?
One thing. We are not the Swiss government. We may make suggestions to the Swiss government. We, as a commission, are not in a status that we develop evaluations, but I realized that not only in Switzerland but also in other countries, now this statement has stimulated a lot of research questions and people are starting to address them. But I think we're not the right group to address that.
Mm-hmm. Other comments from the panel?
There's a question about the broader use of antivirals as preventive agents, and I think that's probably one of the most prolific and important topics going on right now. The meeting next door is about antivirals for pre-exposure prophylaxis. There's at least 10 different topical microbicide trials that are involving different single or combination antiviral agents. So this whole idea of antiviral therapy for prevention, we're focusing now on the infected person, but the package is post-exposure prophylaxis, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it's a field that hasn't realized its potential because there was so much, I don't want to call it commitment, there was so much belief that we would make a vaccine that was going to solve this problem that perhaps the energy that's now being realized in the ART field is kind of surging. And because we can modify drugs, and because some of the newer drugs have very unusual and positive properties for prevention, it seems inevitable to me that the topic that one of the gentlemen asked, it's going to get broader and broader and broader. I think it's also inevitable that we're going to see success, and those successes are going to have to be measured and become part of public health policy. So I think that was a very good question.
Dr. Cohen, someone asked about homosexual transmission, and the study that you're doing, will that include?
Let me clarify something. I think it's incredibly wrong to look at anal intercourse as limited to MSMs. Every single this is wrong. This is about a sex act that is common among heterosexuals as well. I think a recent study came out from Africa. Kate might know the exact number. I think it was something like 12-14% of South African mature couples were actually engaging in heterosexual anal intercourse. So it's about the act, not about the selection of partner. And so that's my number one overriding concern, that we not just focus on MSMs. Now, recognizing, though, that obviously, well, recognizing all the obvious, that this is a behavior that is not well studied. It's a difficult behavior to study. We don't understand the transmission events, the probabilities that occur in that, and we don't understand a lot about ART in that setting. So this is going to require more research. I'd be wrong to say more than that.
Okay. Anyone else?
I want to say hi to my fellow treatment activists from the prevention field. Indeed, the EATG and the community, of course, we support very much the use of new preventive technologies, and they will play perhaps they will be the only solution for the next years. That was one of my statements from the public health impact of the guidelines, that actually prevention is treatment. In the sense that within the comprehensive package with the ways that treatment can be used, as Maron mentioned. I also wanted to say something about what Uli Markus said about, indeed, this statement and what it says in there should be used. We should turn this information into positive outcomes. And STIs are not regularly screened in HIV units, which is, given the data, is criminal. I said that these are preventable and treatable. So screening should be one of the priorities for strategies for people who are followed in clinics.
Thanks.
Okay. I probably, for the sake of full kind of discussion, I have to add something, and this is complicated. And there's one additional paper that you didn't cite by Nago, NAGO, who's in the ARNRS. One problem we have is that HSV2 is very ubiquitous. It's a lifelong disease. It's been very popular in the HIV-SCD overlap field because the shedding of HSV occurs quite silently. And some of the investigators believe that HSV2 shedding, while subclinical, drives HIV shedding as well. What Nago showed in his paper was, this is very recent, that even people on ART, unless they also received acyclovir, had an increased shedding. Now, whether that shedding, now these were females, women, whether that amount of virus is enough to cause a transmission event is totally unknown. There'd be no way to get into that. And I want to separate those two issues. But it is also true that a substantial number of people around the world also have HSV2 infections, which are chronic, asymptomatic, very little clinical consequence to the average person, but it really has to weigh into the whole discussion. So when you talk about screening, it would be very difficult to deal with HSV2 in all candor.
Yes, but okay. I mean, to answer to that, mm-hmm. there was also this question of what kind of research do we need? And indeed, the presence of STIs does not necessarily result in increased risk of HIV transmission. And the other very important research question is there a threshold under which transmission does not occur, whether we need enough of an inoculum in order to have transmission? Therefore, even this shedding that you are describing probably would be irrelevant.
Okay, but let's take maybe three more comments, and then we're going to have a summation of the session. So please, go ahead.
Nick Partridge from Terence Higgins Trust in the UK. I just want a clarification, if I may. I recognize that the statement is good news for a few people. Can I just be clear that those, anyone who enjoys anal sex, are not part of those few people that have good news in this statement? Because that was the suggestion I was getting from you, Mike, that actually, irrespective of sexuality, what the Swiss statement says excludes people who enjoy anal sex.
That is not a true
statement. That's not true. Because the question about anal sex has been sort of dodged. It's been asked four times now. So can we be clear about how the statement goes for zero discordant couples who enjoy anal sex? Just to help me understand it.
I just would like to make very clear that we did not discern anal sex, vaginal sex, whatever sex. The reason why is that the most important source of our confidence was the fact that after 10 years of heart, we don't see these cases, regardless of the mode of sexual contact. So all the other biological arguments help to explain it, but the evidence is the same situation as with household context, as I explained in 1986.
Okay, thank you.
Does that clarify for you?
Can I add something to that?
Yes, please go ahead.
One way to understand this is if you start with the risk of mother-to-child transmission, which is from 20 to 40%, the introduction of one pill or triple combination actually makes transmission very, very unlikely. When you compare that to sexual risk of transmission, which is much lower than the, and I'm talking now about anal risk, which is much higher than vaginal, but still, it does not begin to compare with mother-to-child transmission. If you then have the same impact of the antiretrovirals, it goes to say that the risk is infinitesimal. So what the Swiss have been describing is that it is irrelevant. And that's why in my presentation I said that the reduction of risk is logarithmic and parallels the logarithmic reduction of viral load.
Thank you. Okay, two more comments, yes?
Yes, thank you. I'm Eric Flotelot from SIDAction in France. And I share your concern, Kent, on poor resource settings and viral load test. The availability of viral load tests is very weak, but it means for me that we need to improve access to viral load, and that's it. I have a very naive question, and please be indulgent with me if you think it's a stupid question, but how come it was possible last year to promote circumcision in many high prevalence countries, even if the efficiency of circumcision is lower, if I remember well, is just 60% from women to men, it's lower than the efficiency of prevention of HIV transmission with treatment. So I don't understand why UNAIDS and WHO, are so shy now compared to what you did last year on circumcision. Thank you.
Next comment.
Why don't you treat them?
You know, I think that listening and talking about this statement makes me realize how much this statement is about privilege and the privilege and access to medical care and doctors and, you know, regular treatment and intervention. And I think that it comes with this responsibility and acknowledgement that, you know, there's always a trickle-down effect. And having worked as a provider in both the States and in what is considered the global South, I don't see that in a couple years there's going to be a change, and there's going to be a lot more viral load testing, and there's going to be the possibility of access to medical care in a way that makes this statement relevant to a lot of places. So, I guess what I'm asking is, like, what are the next steps, and what is happening to make this statement true for everyone who's infected with HIV, and you know, how is it becoming a global statement and in a real and practical way?
Thank you.
We have time for another comment?
Yes, please go.
My name is Susanna Atia. I'm from Houston, Texas, working with the Institute of Social and Preventive Medicine in Bern, Switzerland. And we're also looking at the evidence regarding transmissibility of HIV according to usage of heart, viral load, and STIs. And so far, we found is in a review of the literature that the lowest transmitting viral load has been 362 copies per milliliter. And if you'd like to know more, I'm actually presenting on Thursday at 5:15 in session room 11 on this exact topic. So I hope that it's of interest to everyone, can help in this discussion.
Thank you. Kate, did you want to respond?
Yeah.
I'll just respond. We're not shy. Don't worry about that. But what we want to do is to make sure that the messages are well contextualized. Anything that increases the choices for people, the options for people for HIV prevention is important. More people are getting infected each year than all of the ones that are on treatment so far. So we've got a real negative balance here. I think it's important to get the message across that this is for a select few people, and yes, we need to increase viral load testing in countries. We need to decrease the number of people with undiagnosed infection, because that's where the bulk of infections are occurring. And we need to look at options and combinations. So that's why male circumcision, 3 randomized controlled trials, and now further phase 4 trials showing very good results in the community, that's really strong evidence. We're not saying male circumcision replaces everything else. Everything has to be additive and synergistic with what we have.
Thank you.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on the 17th International AIDS Conference from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/AIDS2008.